From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Congress averts a government shutdown, but the debt ceiling, the defense bill, and Biden's agenda still remain on Chuck Schumer's December wish list. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. President Biden on Friday signed a bill to extend government funding through February 18th. Some Republicans earlier this week, including the House Freedom Caucus, had wanted to use this funding expiration as leverage to defund President Biden's vaccine mandates. And the compromise on Thursday was a vote to do so in the Senate, which failed 50-48 because two Republicans were absent. And so, Kim, after all of that drama this week about a potential government shutdown, what was accomplished here?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But, you know, this is what Congress likes to do in December and in the face of deadlines is somebody or some group will suddenly decide that this is an opportunity, potentially because they're facing a deadline, coerce or leverage one of their priorities out of a must-passed bill. And this was obviously a must-pass bill. If it had not gone across the finish line, you would have had a shutdown on the weekend. It probably wouldn't have lasted long because they could have used other procedural methods to get it on the floor. It just would have been a short-term thing. In the end, they decided it probably looked better to simply allow these Republicans to have their vote. I would note on vaccines, I would note that even if those two Republicans hadn't been absent, that this vaccine amendment would have died because all 50 Democrats voted for it, including Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, and they would have been able to bring in Kamala Harris to push it over the line. So, but the Republicans, in short, accomplished what they wanted to, which was to put Democrats on the record as supporting Joe Biden's vaccine mandates. And in the end, the government will not shut down.
The other thing that I find a little odd about this bill is that courts, judges have already blocked these vaccine mandates in broad strokes. And it's true, we're still waiting on another court ruling from the Sixth Circuit. But it's odd to go full on and charge up this hill saying we're gonna get President Biden to defund his own policy through this government spending bill, and then to my eye back off and take a vote that you know is gonna fail in order to save face. Or am I wrong about that? I mean, is there something to the argument, Bill, about putting Democrats in the Senate on the record in favor of these mandates?
Well, we'll find out. I mean, that's clearly what they hope to do. As Kim pointed out, you had two Republicans absent, but without Sinema or Manchin or someone else, it was bound to fail. So maybe they think they could use this. I think they're sensing that mandates are unpopular. They're certainly unpopular in the courts, the way Joe Biden's done it. But as you point out, I mean, it's a very different vote because of all this activity in the courts, right? If it had not been in the courts and the courts ruling this way, I wonder if everyone would have voted the same. So as you point out, the courts kind of stole the thunder from the parties. And as Kim points out, this is what, you know, this is the kind of stuff that Congress spends its time on when they come up against deadlines.
So one of the next items on the agenda is the National Defense Authorization Act, often just called the NDAA. So, Kim, can you give us just a little bit of brief background on a reminder of what the NDAA is and what the holdup there has been?
Yeah, the important thing to remember about the NDAA is that it's a broad authorization. So Congress, when it goes through its formal budget and spending process, at first, committees will pass an authorization bill saying that this is how much they want a top line to spend overall as guidance for a particular department. Later, the appropriators go through the process of actually deciding where the specific dollars go. But the NDAA has always been one of the rare authorization bills in Congress. It tends to speed through both chambers. It's usually done by the summer because because it usually garners a lot of bipartisan support. This is the bill, the authorization that, for instance, you know, funds military pay and funds other aspects of our defense budget. Most members like to be in favor of those things. This time around, for a number of reasons, but I would point out the biggest one simply being that Democrats have been too focused on their other agenda items to get to it. This bill has been delayed for months and months. Suddenly, Schumer decided that he had a window where he could jam it through, brought it up, and not surprisingly, Republicans initially objected to having it rammed through so quickly without a chance to have amendments and debate. So they pushed back earlier this week. There looked to be a deal, but that has been derailed because of some objections by Marco Rubio. They have left town, and we will see what happens next week.
One interesting piece of this NDAA, and it doesn't seem to be the most controversial piece, is there's a provision that would require women to register for selective service, register for the military draft, essentially, in the event that there was another military draft. And notable that supporters on that are on both sides of the aisle. Here's a quote from Senator Joni Ernst, Iowa Republican. She says, "Because we have opened up every position to women in the military, I think it's imperative that women say we want to be treated equally. If that's true, then they should be registering for the draft," unquote. And notable that Joni Ernst is former Army National Guard and has been to Kuwait and been to Iraq. And Bill, I just wonder what you make of that provision.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think up till now, the general position people have had is that women should be allowed to have these roles if they wish to, but women who don't shouldn't be forced like men. Now, maybe public opinion has moved on that. I still think the idea of registering for a draft and compelling women might be a lot more controversial than people now think. But, you know, maybe public opinion has moved in it. I think the bigger thing on the NDAA is the Uyghur Amendment. Look, this is splitting the Democratic Party. I think it's pitting the Democratic human rights wing, you know, which is really against China, and the climate wing, which believes that it needs China to do things. I mean, it's sort of an uncontroversial bill, you know, which the Senate passed 100-0. But now we have reports that the Biden administration wants it watered down. They were having Wendy Sherman from the State Department call some of the Democratic sponsors of this to say they want to water it down. So publicly they're saying one thing and privately they're saying another thing. I think it's a reflection of a confused China policy. They don't have an overarching China policy, so they respond to point by point. And I think if I were China looking at this, I would not be drawing the conclusion that the Biden administration is projecting some strength.
And the point of this amendment, it has to do with blocking goods from China that are made with forced labor from entering the U.S. And a part of the debate that was interesting this week was a constitutional one. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, objected that the amendment offered by Senator Marco Rubio involved some revenue, and so it would have to originate in the House. And we have a piece of Rubio's response to that we'll play here.
And so this is really not about revenue generating. The CBO said it's insignificant, really. This is about the fact that they don't want this bill to pass over in the House. And I understand why. Listen, there's some big companies out there, some very big companies. We know that for a time, Apple and Nike, a lot of big companies are pushing against it. They're not going to admit it. Who's going to go out lobbying in favor of slave labor?
Kim, what's your read of this debate, and what path do you see more broadly for the NDAA here as we go into the holidays?
So what you saw here this week was Senator Rubio essentially engaging in a throwdown because he's very frustrated, and reasonably so. There, as Bill noted, the Senate passed this Uyghur bill months ago on a huge bipartisan basis. There were no objections. It was done on a voice vote. Democrats claim in the House to be in favor of it as well, but they've just been sitting on it and sitting on it and sitting on it. And it's because, again, as Bill Kyle alluded to, there's a strong suspicion that the White House now wants changes. They say they want a more targeted approach because they don't want to ruffle China's feathers. So Rubio is essentially saying, I'm going to continue objecting to this process in the Senate until I get this amendment. The point about Schumer, too, this is notable. What actually happened is that some unnamed member of the House used what's called a blue slip facility to object to the amendment in the Senate because of the argument that all revenues need to originate in the House. And Schumer leapt on that. And so it's increasingly looking as though this is a Democratic strategy to simply delay this until they can modify and make it in a way that they want it to be. That was enough, though, to derail talks this week. We now have a plan B emerging, I think, as an attempt to kind of force Republicans. Democrats are now threatening that they'll just go and conference with the House, come up with a bill, have the House pass it, and present the Senate with a fait accompli, which Republicans wouldn't like because they wouldn't get any chance to amend it. On the other hand, some Democrats suggested that they might be open to including the provision or moving, finally, Mr. Rubio's bill in the House. So we're not going to get a solution to this till early next week, but he has accomplished his goal of putting some attention on how long this has been delayed.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Third on the December to-do list for Chuck Schumer is raising the debt ceiling. This is a conversation that has been going on for a while now. You had that confrontation between Schumer and Republican leader Mitch McConnell, which led to a breakthrough, and they passed a short-term deal. The latest from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is that the Treasury's borrowing authority is supposed to run out on December 15th. She said that last month. I've seen some analyses by third-party groups that are saying the real date is more, it's somewhere in January. But Bill, I mean, here we have again, we started out with government funding, and here we have again what seems to be a classic Beltway drama. Does anybody doubt that the debt ceiling is going to be raised in the end, and it's just a question of who is going to give how much?
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's a Beltway drama, right? The outcome really isn't in doubt. We're not going to default. I think the date, as you point out, will probably slip to January. They have so many other things to do. You know, I think the whole pattern of this was designed to originally to put a lid on spending. I don't think it's achieved that purpose. I think it gives us a lot of false dramas and would probably be better off without it. Without this kind of vote. And it just shifts depending on which party's in power and which party's in the White House, you know, who's on the side trying to slow it down or vote against it and who's on the side that wants it to get through quietly as fast as you can.
So what are the stakes here, Kim? And has there been any movement in Washington on how to get this done? I mean, the original conflict between Schumer and McConnell was McConnell took the position and he said, Democrats hold all the levers of power in Washington, so they need to raise the debt ceiling on their own. And as far as I can tell, Schumer has not started the process of doing that through a separate reconciliation bill. And so where do we stand here as we near another deadline?
And it is all entirely political still. Remember that the last time this happened, McConnell said, we're not going to give you the votes that you need to get to 60 to commence this process of a standalone raise of the debt limit. They ultimately caved on that because Democrats simply did not come up with an alternative and the threat of default was sitting out there. Now they're saying they are willing to allow the Democrats to do it. They won't object. But the thorny question is how can Republicans do that without providing the votes again to a motion to proceed to get on a bill? And nobody wants to be the Republican who votes for that again. So there has been some talk of including a provision in separate legislation, who knows what that vehicle would be, that would essentially, it might be unrelated legislation. Republicans could vote to get on that bill or vote to pass that bill, but there would be a provision inside of it that then allowed Democrats to have the power to unilaterally raise the debt limit for some period of time with some very strict parameters about by how much, et cetera. The other option, as you said, is reconciliation. It would be very risky to bet it on the larger reconciliation bill that Democrats are promoting at the moment because it's very unclear that it'll pass before the end of the year. And in time, it does sound as though the Senate parliamentarian has told Schumer he could break out something, but there just still doesn't seem to be any appetite. Now, we know that Schumer and McConnell are talking about this, and I think that there are proposals going back and forth. It still suggests it will get done, but the actual mechanism for that is still very unclear.
Finally, the fourth item on the agenda is Build Back Better. This is President Biden's spending bill, social spending bill. And reportedly, Chuck Schumer is saying that he could bring that up on the floor for a vote as soon as December 13th, so a couple of weeks from now. And Bill, as we've discussed on this program, there are all sorts of issues that, again, to me, remain unsolved. This state and local tax deduction is a big one, and I'm skeptical that we're going to get on the floor here unless we see any sort of real movement on Democrats among themselves coming to a consensus on what they want the bill to look like.
Yes. Remember how many times Nancy Pelosi promised to vote on certain dates and then it didn't happen. It didn't happen because there are fundamental disagreements and we don't know. We don't know what Chuck Schumer can do to please Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Will the bill that would please them, would the Senate agree on that and not have a revolt then when it went back to the House and, you know, being different. So I think they still have a lot of problems. And, you know, this isn't just a Biden spending bill. This is his signature piece of domestic legislation. And I think it's in real trouble. And, you know, one reason they wanted to muscle it through so quickly, you know, a month or so ago is because they knew the longer this takes, the less likely, the less imperative it becomes to get something through. So I'm not sure we're in any better place to get this through than we were a month ago, 2 months ago, or 3 months ago.
And is trying to rush that or to pressure Democrats on Schumer's part, is that playing with fire a little bit? It was interesting. There was a reporter who was talking to Joe Manchin on Thursday, and he asked, if Schumer were to put this bill on the floor, what would you do? And Joe Manchin said, I wouldn't have any idea how I'm going to vote until I walk in, unquote. And if you're the leader of the faction, if you're Chuck Schumer leading Democrats in the Senate, that's a pretty uncomfortable place to be, Kim, when you're trying to get your president's agenda through.
It would be complete member mismanagement. And I would think that if Chuck Schumer and Democrats have learned anything, that there isn't necessarily an upside to pressuring Joe Manchin. He doesn't fold necessarily. I mean, sometimes he comes around to things in the end, but he's also been showing a great deal of bitterness about the accusations that have been made about him and the targeting and harassment of him. So, and he's put out some pretty touchy statements as well, too. including, interestingly, just a few weeks ago when President Biden tapped the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, he put out a somewhat acidic statement saying that it was a useful policy band-aid, but was no, it wasn't a fix for having an all-of-the-above energy policy and dealing with inflation. So again, reiterating his big grievances with some of the core aspects of this bill, including the climate provisions that are in the bill and overall spending. He's also been making some noises again, too, about budget gimmicks and how programs need to be paid for over 10 years. I mean, I would wager if Chuck Schumer just decided he was going to try to jam Joe Manchin and brought this to the floor, it's a big question about whether or not Manchin would vote to proceed. But the other question is, even if he voted to proceed, all he has to do is offer any amendment he wants that's going to change the bill, make it smaller or more his direction, and he'd get every Republican senator to vote with him. And so, you know, that would be playing with fire and putting the process in the hands of a very unhappy senator on the floor.
The other moving part here is the Senate parliamentarian. There's also some reporting this week that each side presented the parliamentarian with their arguments on pieces of this bill that need to be struck because they aren't budgetary. And remember, under what's called the Byrd rule, a reconciliation bill is supposed to only have things in it that are germane to budgetary measures. And one of the big ones, Bill, is immigration. There are immigration provisions in there that seem pretty obvious. Obviously, to outside observers, are going to be struck by the parliamentarian. So we're waiting to see how she actually rules. And then I guess we're waiting to see also how the progressives who have demanded those provisions be part of the bill, how they react to that striking.
Well, they won't have a choice if the parliamentarian rules against them. As you say, I mean, it's supposed to be revenue related. Now, you could say, you could point to almost anything and say it will have some revenue implications, but clearly what they want is an immigration policy piece, you know, rather than a budgetary item. So I agree with you. I find it hard to believe that the parliamentarian will allow this. And I think it's another another bitter pill for the progressives. You know, they've lost so much of what they wanted in their spending. And then if the parliamentarian rules this out, you know, there's just a lot of disgruntled members like that because they feel they're not getting what they want. But the question is, will they settle for not everything they want, or will they say, well, the hell with it. If we're not going to get any of this stuff, I'm not voting for it.
Kim, what's your read of how the parliamentarian's ruling is going to mix up the politics here? And aside from the immigration provisions, are there other pieces of the bill as it has been passed in the House that are vulnerable to this kind of parliamentary challenge? And Kim, we'll give you the last word here.
Sure. The politics of this are actually quite complex. One of the reasons that the House bill contained this immigration provision, even though things had been struck down already by the parliamentarian, different versions of this program, is that Nancy Pelosi had a handful of members who said that they simply would not vote for the bill unless it had an immigration piece to it. And they appeared to mean it. And that just goes to show you the complexity, again, of the math in the House. She couldn't lose more than three votes here. Now, what happens if the parliamentarian nixes it? What happens if the Senate actually does get something through and it doesn't contain it? Can she get it through the House? Maybe the pressure will be such. But right now, there's a lot of warring problems for her. The other things, in addition to immigration, there are a number of labor provisions in this bill. For instance, just a good example, the one that says you get an even bigger tax credit if your electric vehicle is made at a union shop. There's a lot of doubt that the parliamentarian would let something like that go through because it's so policy-based. There's also some provisions that have to do with prescription drug controls. No one is doubting much the ability of this bill to enforce them in the context of Medicare negotiations, government negotiations of prices, drug prices. But the bill also, for instance, contains like price controls in the private sector on insulin and some other drugs. And there's some real doubts that that would pass muster, again, because it has nothing to do with federal revenue per se. We don't know the whole list because, interestingly, both sides tend to be pretty quiet about what they bring to the parliamentarian on the view that going public with her would look like they're pressuring her and could backfire. But expect in the next few weeks to get a lot of announcements from the parliamentarian.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.